Last weekend was President's Day weekend. President's Day celebrates great American leadership. When I was a youngster, we celebrated February 22nd as Washington's birthday and February 12th as Lincoln's. But we only got Washington's birthday off from school. Now they've Mundialized just about everything. And though Washington's actual birthday is tomorrow, the official holiday was 6 days ago. Celebrating the legacy of people like Lincoln and Washington encourages us to ask, what makes a great leader? What are some of the essential qualities of leadership? First of all, so just by way of introduction, let me say a few things, get them off my chest. First of all, leadership... Well, leaders are not managers. They might have some management things that you got to attend to, but leaders cast a vision, one that others pick up on and lend their support to. Leaders set an example. I always think of one of the best ministers I've known, Carl Scovel, who for years was in one of the big churches in Boston. But you'd always see him in the kitchen with his sleeves rolled up, washing dishes. That's part of the way he led. Now, there's an issue for ministers about members of congregations often are encouraging you to get out and do the work of the church. And by which they mean, you know, being a prophetic voice in the community, mobilizing support across the area for important things that we all believe in. But if the minister doesn't do enough internal church work, by which I mean attend to the infrastructure, support the leaders in their personal struggles, work on a day-to-day basis to make things flow and to make communication easy, she will be hampered, stymied, really, in her efforts to do the work of the church effectively in the larger community. So attending to these matters, the kind of down-to-earth, nitty-gritty, churchy infrastructure concerns is necessary if you want to do the grander issues. Attend to them. Truly great leaders are held up as cultural heroes and heroines. People who, in the face of danger and adversity or from a position of weakness, display courage and the will for self-sacrifice, heroism, in support of some greater good for all humanity. This definition usually refers to martial courage or excellence, but it can also mean moral excellence. I once read a list of superheroes compiled by some scholar, and he attributed all kinds of, attributed points for various heroic abilities and capacities. At the top of the list, Jesus and Buddha. They had something like 32, 33 points apiece, followed by Socrates with 30, and down the list, Alexander the Great, Teresa of Avila, Martin Luther, and so on, all the way down to the likes of Evel Knievel. I have no memory of where he came in on that hero list, but George Washington comes in near the very top of mine. The 18th century was very different from today. It's not easy to identify with its customs or its people. George Washington, in the popular imagination of today, comes off as kind of wooden and aristocratic. In fact, he had wooden teeth. And we go, who is this guy in the pictures? And maybe we're still in some of your grade schools when you were young. He doesn't look like a sweet uncle you could cozy up to. Nothing could be further from the truth. He was a daring revolutionary, radical, creative, and yet able to restrain and focus his extraordinary energies until just the right moment. Good timing was one of his gifts, too. Who was he, really? Born in 1732, his father died when he was only 11 years old. And with that death, George's dreams of studying abroad, as his older brothers had, or of landing a commission in the British Army, were immediately curtailed. Adjusting his sights downward, young Washington took up surveying. Luckily, wealthy and cultivated neighbors, Sally and George Fairfax, befriended him. Sally, in particular, noticed this diamond in the rough as a future world citizen and paved the way for that to happen. She and her husband introduced George to many among the socially prominent, politically connected first families of Virginia. Drawn into the world of his sophisticated patrons, George embarked on a serious self-improvement campaign, copying a long list of personal habits he wished to cultivate. His own personal rules of civility and decent behavior in company and conversation. For example, the fourth rule. In the presence of others, sing not to yourself with a humming noise, nor drum with your fingers or feet. 41st, undertake not to teach your equal in the art himself professes. It savors of arrogancy. Some of our presidential candidates. Number 110. So much one of my favorites that I listed in the bulletin. Labor to keep alive in your breast that little spark of celestial fire called conscience. Perhaps these rules helped. In time, fully internalized, he grew into a person with a remarkable sense of decorum and integrity. It's important to add, given the era, that Washington was also, in Thomas Jefferson's words, the finest horseman of his age. The fellow could ride a horse, and he looked great on it, as though they were one animal. He was tall, handsome, and an excellent horseman. Well, he blended well into colonial Virginia society. Efforts on behalf of the Virginia militia during the French and Indian War, Washington was in his 20s, led to battle testing and familiarity with the terrain across the Appalachians and up and down the Ohio Valley. His record of victories there was not enviable. His training, as things turned out, was indispensable. His qualities of fairness and dedication necessary for any leader were honed. More important still, he refined an intuitive gift for absorbing the rapidly changing gestalt that is the battlefield and making immediate, strategically effective decisions. He was cool, as they say, indeed, very cool under fire. He married a wealthy widow, Martha Custis, becoming part of the 1%. Despite her grand first marriage, Martha Washington's own family background had been modest, and she preserved kind, unassuming ways. Her genius lay not in cleverness or aesthetics, but in the area of relationship building. By all accounts, she was warm-hearted, gentle, and direct of speech. Wealthy the Washingtons were, but they were not snobs. Nor were they disconnected from the worries and aspirations of the 99% countrymen and women with whom they increasingly came to identify. In trying to understand our first president, it's important to remember that above all, he was a frontiersman. Far more familiar actually talking and sitting in consulate with Indians than any other of our presidents. He became involved in land speculation, which added to his wealth. More importantly, he began to recognize, long before most others of his class and culture, that America's future lay westward, not linked up with England far to the east across the sea. The key aspect of Jefferson's remark that Washington was the finest horseman of his age, it seems to me, is the observation that he was totally at home with the technology of the mid-18th century frontier, horses and surveyor's tools. To be totally at home with the technology of the 21st century, a comparable leader of today wouldn't be a race car driver, but she would be totally at home in the saddle, as it were, when it comes to moving comfortably along the electronic communications frontier. In Washington's case, we have a handsome young man, tall, graceful, and well-to-do, though not an aristocrat, and increasingly distrustful of aristocracy and all its trappings. He liked dancing, and he was a good dancer. He liked entertainment. He liked spectacles of any kind. In fact, he would stop, even in the Revolutionary War, if he thought he had time. There's one time, I think, after Monmouth, and the English are, you know, they're not all that far away, but there's a puppet show. And he said, oh, let's stop and watch. Any spectacle, he was totally into it. Temperamentally a gambler at cards and at war, he was not afraid to take a well-calculated risk when it offered good chance for success. More and more, he saw with clarity the economics of the colonists' situation and became increasingly radicalized. Like others of his era and class, he believed in the values of the Enlightenment, especially the value of reason. He began to talk with his neighbors about the political wisdom of launching a revolution against empire. Leadership, as I noted earlier, is not to be confused with management. It typically involves management, and indeed great leaders are almost always good managers, too. But leadership is more than management alone. I think of my scoutmaster, Carl Brew. He led by way of integrity, his fairness, and his dedication, qualities that George Washington had, too. Another quality Mr. Brew shared with Washington was leading by example, as did Carl Scoble, who I mentioned before. In Washington's case, by hanging in there with his soldiers through coldness and privation, through battle losses and extended non-payment, through discontent and betrayal, leading by example, Washington somehow, 8 years later, ended up having defeated the largest imperial force on the face in the history of the planet. He was always able to think outside the box. He lost most of his battles, except the last one when it mattered most. He perfected guerrilla warfare when he found he could not win conventionally. He rallied loyal forces from every corner of every colony and hung in there until their glorious cause was achieved, at which time he handed in his commission and returned home. Days beforehand, there was a moment, March 15th, 1783, when everything hung in the balance. This was after Cornwallis had surrendered, and the event was in Newburgh, New York, in the Hudson Valley, not far from West Point. Disgruntled officers, sullen from having never been paid, began the rumblings of a coup d'etat. When the commander-in-chief strode in unannounced and up to the dais, their rumblings continued. He who had led them in battle now appealed to their reason. He spoke of his years of service with and his love for his comrades. They were unmoved. He spoke of avoiding civil discord. Their anger and resentment grew. Awkwardly, He pulled a letter from his pocket, at which point, suddenly, things appeared to go wrong. He looked confused and stared at the paper helplessly. The officers, concerned he was unwell, leaned forward, their hearts filled with anxiety. The general then pulled from another pocket something only 4 or 5 people had ever seen him wear. A pair of eyeglasses. "Gentlemen," he said with marked embarrassment, "you will permit me to put on my spectacles, for I have not only gone gray, but almost blind in the service of my country." This unrehearsed confession had the effect his arguments had failed to achieve. Hardened comrades began to weep, and the threat of coup evaporated on the spot. What Washington could not accomplish out of strength, he was able to bring about through acknowledgement of his vulnerability. Another sign of uncommon, indeed extraordinary, leadership. When you can't lead through strength, to be able to lead and have the openness of heart to lead through weakness. Then he retired. Like the 5th century farmer Lucius Quintus Cincinnatus, who successfully led the armies of Rome and then retired to his farm, Washington went home, willfully, joyfully home to Mount Vernon. He returned to public service a few years later to preside over the writing of the Constitution and then, as president, help to bring its plan, self-government, to fruition as our first president. He then retired for good. At the time of his death in 1799, 2.5 years after leaving office, Thomas Jefferson wrote, "Perhaps the strongest feature of his character was prudence, never acting until every circumstance, every consideration had been maturely weighed. Refraining if he saw doubt, but when once decided, going through his purpose, whatever obstacles opposed. His integrity was the most pure, his justice the most inflexible I have ever known. He was, indeed, in every sense of the words, a wise, a good, and great man." One of his officers, Henry Lee, summed up contemporary public opinion: first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his country. I love history, and I've read the biographies of over a dozen American presidents. Recently, I listened through, and it was a lot of listening, Carl Sandburg's 6-volume biography of Abraham Lincoln, who many consider number one. I love Lincoln too, but I mark him as number two. He preserved, but Washington established. Here's what makes George Washington, in my estimation, our greatest chief executive. Number one, he gave it up. He gave it up 3 times as general of the Revolutionary Army, as would-be king of the Constitutional Convention, and as president. Compare this to Napoleon, Chairman Mao, Fidel, or any other revolutionary honcho. Power never corrupted him, nor the seductive fantasy that all would deteriorate should he not be in charge. Number two, he was never intimidated by others' brilliance. Good leaders are magnanimous, spreading credit for their successes widely, while conversely taking responsibility for failures. He chose Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, men of incomparable genius, as his 2 closest aides. And both of them, in 5 minutes and 2 minutes, you know they were both a lot smarter than Washington. But neither of them, in fact, no one, ever doubted who was in charge. By nature a man of action, he learned to temper a fiery disposition by listening carefully to trusted aides, and only then, after careful deliberation, acting. 3. Most of all, I love Washington for his unfailing commitment to a vision of democracy. He was one of perhaps the wealthiest persons in America. He has been described by some as increasingly conservative toward the end of his presidency. But the categories of contemporary politics don't really apply. He was a Federalist. Federalists believed in government, especially the federal government, and believed that it could and should improve and uplift the lives of their countrymen. They were 180 degrees across the political dial from the Tea Partiers of today. It's my belief that President Washington, as he peered into the young republic's future, came to favor Hamilton's vision of an emerging capitalist economy over Jefferson's agrarian model because it was the only way Washington could foresee the country shaking off the economic burden and moral curse of slavery. And indeed, George Washington was the only one of the founding fathers to free all his slaves, which he did in his will. He was not a saint. He had a temper, and he could be a flirt. They say George Washington slept here, you know, I don't know. There's some truth to that. It is humanizing to learn that while he was a dutiful son, he struggled, as many people do, with his mom, Mary Ball Washington. He was generous to her in every way. Nevertheless, she embarrassed him publicly and repeatedly for neglecting her and dismissed his patriotic deeds as largely a matter of undeserved luck. Thanks. You know, I thought my mom gave me a hard time. And you figure, you know, a successful revolution, he helps draft the Constitution, he serves as an extraordinary president of the United States. He's just lucky. Being a great parish minister requires leadership skills, certainly. And you're contemplating what you're looking for in a minister, so that's partly why I do this. Being a good leader of any kind requires many attributes, some obvious and others less so. One metaphor that I like when contemplating leadership is the metaphor of a ship. Washington, incidentally, made only one sea voyage in his life to Barbados as a teenager along with his older half-brother, Lawrence, and then his brother died there. It was naturally a very sad trip, and he never discussed it. But he did contact and recover from smallpox while in the Caribbean, which gave him immunity to a disease that would later decimate troops on both sides throughout the revolution. In any case, I like to think of ministry in certain ways as an ocean-going sailing ship. Such vessels require plenty of sail and, below the surface, a deep and solid keel. No sail and the ship flounders. Too much sail without a counterbalancing keel and you'll go up on the rocks. So it is that the strongest, most resilient ministries are like great sailing vessels with plenty of sail and with deep, solid keels beneath the waterline. Like many generals, Washington had a lot of sail. He loved wearing a uniform, resisted airs of familiarity, and was at home in the spotlight. But he also developed as a leader by deepening and strengthening his keel. It was as a supply general that he made his mark. Detailed requisition documents, careful inventory, and lengthy reports to civilian authorities written almost daily and with meticulous detail. He was not fond of what today we'd call networking, schmoozing with critical powers that be in order to help make things happen and move agenda along. Though he never was keen on its painstaking courtesies, Washington learned how to network and also how to reap its benefits. In conclusion, let us be thankful for the wonderful examples we have been given of effective leadership Examples like President and General George Washington. May we be inspired by him and other heroines and heroes in our own efforts to nurture and strengthen and make whole our hearts and consciences. May we be made stronger by their virtue, their creativity, and their love of humanity. And through it all, may we humbly do the best we can to bring more good into our world, our communities, and our homes. Amen, and blessed be.